we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatments of animals.
And the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, December 8th, 2017. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Jillian Walters.
Hey, hi.
And our control room operator, Amira Lee.
Hello.
Welcome, everyone. International Human Rights Day is this Sunday, December 10th. Our show, as the name implies, is focused on animal rights, but today we'll be exploring some of the many ways in which animal and human rights causes intersect and relate to one another. We'll look at parallels between the subjugation of animals and the oppression of people of color, women, and other marginalized groups. Our feature interview is with writer and activist Christopher Sebastian McJetters, who will share with us his compelling insights on the connections between animal liberation and black liberation, LGBTQ liberation, and much more. That's coming up in just over half an hour, so stay tuned. Soon we'll also be sharing an interview with Carol J. Adams, author of the iconic feminist treatise, The Sexual Politics of Meat. But first, Amir has some thoughts to share with us on a topic that is often controversial in human and animal rights activism.
Yeah, and this is a topic that I've been consumed with for a large portion of my vegan life, which spans back about 6 years now. As Elise mentioned, Sunday is International Human Rights Day, and that is the theme of our show. You know, the station being where it is, on your way here, it's hard not to think about and consider what human rights really means when there are sidewalks full of people asleep without a home, struggling with addiction and mental illness. However, being a show primarily about animal rights, it allows us to connect to issues and topics in ways that are unique, but sometimes also controversial. When it comes to human rights and animal rights, bridging the gap between the two could potentially be the missing link when it comes to freedom in both realms. To lead into our discussion, I'm going to quote a few philosophers of yesteryear who are probably more intelligent than I am. Greek philosopher Pythagoras said, "For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seed of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." Jewish writer Isaac Singer said, "People often say that humans have always eaten animals, as if this is the justification for continuing the practice. According to this logic, we should not try to prevent people from murdering other people, since this has also been done since the earliest of times." As you can see, this leads into a common theme with other notable thinkers. "As long as there are slaughterhouses, there will be battlefields," said Russian writer Leo Tolstoy. "While we ourselves are the living graves of murdered beasts, how can we expect any ideal conditions on this earth?" said George Bernard Shaw. And even Albert Einstein said, "Vegetarian food leaves a deep impression on our nature. If the whole world adopts vegetarianism, it can change the destiny of humankind." So we see this common discourse from all these profound philosophers of yesterday, yet when people today bring up any connection between animal rights and human rights, usually it is met with great hostility. There have been people who have made comparisons between the cruelty and mass killing of animals and the Holocaust or slavery. And again, these comparisons are understandably sometimes met with great adversity. Yet a Holocaust survivor himself, Dr. Alex Hirschhaft, made the comparisons on his own on a Reddit AMA a few years ago. If you don't know what a Reddit AMA is, it's just like a Q&A that takes place on Reddit, basically.
I think it stands for Ask Me Anything.
Right? It does, yeah. It stands for Ask Me Anything, and people request people to ask questions to. So Alex Hirschhaft is also the founder of the U.S. Animal Rights Movement, and he said, "My first-hand experience with animal farming was instrumental. I noted the many similarities between how the Nazis treated us and how we treat animals, especially those raised for food. Among these are the use of cattle cars for transport and crude wood crates for housing, the cruel treatment and deception about impending slaughter, the processing efficiency and emotional detachments of the perpetrators, and the piles of assorted body parts, mute testimonials to the victims they were once a part of. Now, just a disclaimer, by quoting a Holocaust survivor's thoughts on similarities between the Holocaust and animal enslavement, animal cruelty, and exploitation, I'm by no means trying to suggest that all Holocaust survivors feel this way, or that this is the ultimate way to think about how animals are exploited, or saying that this is how I feel myself, but merely trying to say that there maybe is a point in bringing up the comparisons if people who have lived through these nightmares can bring up these comparisons. So, as I turn to my co-host for discussion about this controversial issue, I want to ensure our listeners we are merely expressing our opinions and not trying to parade our opinions around as absolute fact by any means whatsoever. So yeah, I wonder what you guys think about making those comparisons and if there is some credence to doing so.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say I really appreciate your thoughts and your research on this, Amir. That's really thought-provoking, you know, all those quotes and everything. It's very profound.
Yeah, and they, you know, course back to, like, thousands of years, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Exactly. Ancient Greece and everything. Yeah, so people obviously have been thinking about this for a long time and sort of drawing parallels between the subjugation of humans and of non-human animals. And I think it's, obviously, it is, like you said, it's a very delicate subject. You know, it's one where I think people, especially those in relative positions of privilege, can pretty easily overstep our bounds, you know. I think it's something we have to go about very sensitively. But yeah, it's I don't know, Jillian, do you have thoughts about this?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how we view animals as opposed to humans.
Right.
You know, sentient beings, do they suffer? Like, do we see them as equal in suffering and pain?
I think quite often the reason why these comparisons are considered extremely offensive is because most people still see non-human animals as less than humans, which, you know, it is sort of understandable. I mean, people historically, a lot of oppression has been based on certain groups being dehumanized or being treated as less than human or lesser forms of humans, and compared to animals, because again, the overall conception of non-human animals is that they are less than us. They're less evolved, less intelligent, you know, less worthy of moral consideration. So I think that it's only when we start to conceive of animals differently, when we start to recognize their sentience and their intelligence and, you know, their capacity for suffering, their capacity for feeling, and how similar they really are to us in so many ways, I think that's when we start to see more of these comparisons.
Definitely. Yeah. And you touched on something before the show, like, the fact that we do sometimes, meet these ideas and concepts with hostility definitely shows. I mean, we're a show that we're trying to, you know, tell people that maybe we should be looking at animals more closely to ourselves. And obviously that means that people who do feel hostile towards these ideas think that animals still are beneath us and are not worthy of being talked about on an unequal level.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do wonder sometimes whether it's wise to kind of use these comparisons in our advocacy, only because I think they do tend to shut people down, especially if, for example, you know, say if I, as somebody who is white or white passing, you know, was to talk to a person of color and compare, say, you know, the farming of animals to slavery, like black slavery, I feel like a lot of people would understandably shut down and kind of, you know, stop listening, just, you know.
Yeah,
there's
so many examples of that happening, you know, over the course of the last few years, especially where the animal rights movement has really exploded and people are sort of jumping the gun and taking matters into their own hands to make these kinds of comparisons, which is definitely not in their place to do so.
Right.
And it's knowing when to make that comparison, if at all, and whether to use other words to describe.
Yeah, and that's why I brought up the Dr. Alex Hirschhaft, because obviously he has every right to, you know, be stating what he was. There's also a book that I just thought, if our listeners were interested in this idea, that basically the whole book is about this idea, comparing the Holocaust to the enslavement of animals. And it was by the author, Jewish author Isaac Singer, called, I might not be pronouncing it right, but Eternal Treblinka, Our Treatment of Animals in the Holocaust. So, yeah, if you're interested in learning more about this subject, then definitely take a look at that book.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is something that very many members of marginalized groups have talked about and thought about and written about over the years. I think it is, you know, it's certainly something worth thinking about, I think. It's just we have to be sensitive and when we pull these things out.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm so glad we're talking about this today.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. And I know that Christopher will touch on a lot more of this in the interview.
Yeah,
as
I'm
well.
Looking forward to that. So yeah, staying tuned for that for sure. Dylan, you got some news for us, I guess.
Yes. Did you know that SFU continues to refuse to release the numbers of animals they use in their research? UBC has shared that they use 167,019 animals just in the year of 2016. Wow. And most of the research, 60% of the research is called basic, so it's curiosity-driven. So there's no cure or end product in mind. An important way to help animals this giving season is to make sure your generous donations do not fund animal experimentation. And did you know that the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society launched its new HumaneCharities.ca campaign this year? And that is a database that you can go to and you can see what charities use their funding for animal experiments and which ones don't. So you can choose to donate your money to a charity that does not experiment on animals.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Remember the Stop Animal Labs campaign we debuted at St. Paul's about a few weeks ago with our light show? To date, it has received 11,000 signatures and counting. And every week, the Mayor of Vancouver, BC Health Minister, and the Hospital Administration receives updates. So I'll keep you guys updated for that. Mm-hmm. Also very interesting, and I shared it on our Facebook page today, is the website for Flow in the UK. They are making huge strides right now. They are pressing for a parliamentary convened debate on the validity of basing human medicine and toxicology on animal models. Mm. And the ADAV team here in Vancouver is working closely with Flow to get a debate here in Canada. So stay tuned and keep informed. It's a really exciting time for that.
Can you remind us what ADAV stands for?
Yes, it's a long word. The Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society.
Right.
And they have been around Vancouver for 90 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
It's pretty awesome bunch of people.
Didn't the, there was some ruling in the UK recently that, that animals can't feel pain or something, right?
What?
I feel like that's related to what you were just bringing up.
Yeah, right? I saw that and
there seems to have been so much stuff being talked about the exact opposite of that for the last so many years now. That's
exactly.
How can anyone come to a ruling like that anyway?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
A different
I think it's
show.
Just very convenient, right?
So last week I announced that Chester's sudden death was due to a bacterial infection.
Chester,
the whale from Vancouver Aquarium.
Right.
And I think a few days later, Vancouver Aquarium made an announcement that they are bringing in two walruses. Mm. I think they are 6 months of age, and they're supposed to stay with their moms for 2 to 3 years. So.
And these walruses were wild captured, I understand, right?
I'm not sure.
I think based on the protest that's going to be taking place, I think that's the case, that there were wild captures, but I could be wrong about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they came from another aquarium or something, right?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting to me because there's been so much campaigning in recent years to get them to stop bringing cetaceans.
The audacity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like,
and the park board obviously has ruled against displaying captive cetaceans. And so now they're kind of working around that by just bringing in walruses, bringing in other marine mammals.
You'd think people would. Well, we're calling for a full-on boycott. I mean, enough is enough.
Yeah.
There's been 42 deaths at the facility in the 54 years that it's been around.
Wow. So many of those cetacean deaths have been really premature, too, right? Most of them have. In fact,
I think all of them.
Yeah. 9 out of the 10 captive-born beluga calves died before the age of 3.
Wow. And Chester, who you mentioned earlier, was a false killer whale, and he died at 3 years of age, right? They claim that they rescued him, but I guess had no intention of ever releasing him after he was rehabilitated.
Exactly.
Yeah. But he was 3 years old when he died. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, false killer whales can live up to about 55 in the wild.
Yeah,
so he was just a baby.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, as you know, Health Canada is in the process of changing the archaic system of the health guide, and very excited that that dairy category is going to be gone, and there's going to be lots of focus on vegetables and fruit, whole grains, and protein-rich foods that don't include animals.
Cool.
So, the animal agriculture is lobbying heavily, of course, as they always do. But what you can do, you can lobby as well. You can see your local MP, and there's some documents online you can print out and take with you. So me and Kingston are going to go to see our local MP, Terry Beach, today after this and talk about that with him.
Excellent.
So I encourage everybody to do that.
Good. And we can post some things on our Facebook page about that, right, Jillian? Can you
post that? Yes, I will post that today.
Excellent. On the Animal Voices Vancouver Facebook page. Thank you very much, Jillian. So now we're going to play for you an interview with vegan feminist author and scholar Carol J. Adams, presented by Matthew Traw of Vegan Talk. Traw asks Adams about her seminal work, The Sexual Politics of Meat, about the changes she has seen in both the vegan and feminist movements over the years, and what advice she'd give to vegans living in a carnist world. So here's Carol J. Adams on Vegan Talk.
I'm Carol J. Adams. I'm the author of The Sexual Politics of Meat. And we're here at the Animal Museum for the opening of the SPOM, the Sexual Politics of Meat art exhibit, which represents the work of 14 women artists responding to my book and creating art in response to these ideas that I articulate in Sexual Politics of Meat. Sexual Politics of Meat was published in 1990. It argues there's a link between living in a patriarchal world and eating dead animals and eating what I called feminized protein. Protein produced by cows and chickens while they're alive. It says, or it articulates a series of arguments. The first is that in our culture, we've got a connection between meat and masculinity, so that vegetables are devalued, and there's a certain anxiety for masculinity, or it's destabilized by veganism and vegetarianism. So I explore that. Then I proposed a concept called the absent referent, in which I said animals are absent referents in meat eating and dairy and egg production. In other words, they disappear from our consciousness to become makers of our food or the food itself. And they disappear in three ways. They disappear literally, they're killed. They disappear in body because they're cut up and reshaped. And they disappear conceptually. We rename them and then we take their oppression and use it as a metaphor for other things. I also argue that women are absent reference in our culture because of a patriarchal world in which what we want to do with our lives is denied. And the feminist movement is our response to the making of us as absent reference. Reproductive choice is a great example about for the problem we face these days. Then I argue that there is a trinity of forces, objectification, in which we no longer see another being as someone, but something. Fragmentation, when we cut that being up, and consumption, where we consume the being. And that we literally consume animals, and we visually consume women. Finally, I argue that veganism, or complete vegetarianism, is a nonverbal refusal of a patriarchal world. So that veganism inevitably expresses a feminist perspective. Veganism has had an incredible sort of flowering of attention. Some of this is for health reasons, and some of this is because celebrities have adopted veganism, which all becomes problematic if the celebrities stop being vegan, or if we start believing that veganism is going to take care of every health problem. It's not. I'm a vegan for ethical reasons, and I appreciate the opportunity the rising attention to veganism allows us to talk about the fate of animals' lives. But that's the key to my my articulation of my theory. Also, there's an incredible amount of vegan food. Anybody who says, well, what do you eat, they haven't been in a grocery store, for heaven's sakes. I drink almond milk or cashew milk or soy milk or Brazil nut milk or oat milk. I can eat tofu, which is sort of the hitting bag, the punch bag for people who are against veganism. They all think, oh, tofu, who wants tofu? But I say that tofu is like an empty palette, empty canvas waiting for a cook to put their flavor on. All the choices, the emergence of different kinds of burgers these days, Impossible Burger, the Beast Burger, the incredible vegan restaurants around the world. Really, it offers people an opportunity to experience veganism and all of its great sensuous aspects. Veganism, feminism, we're in trouble. We've got somebody like Kellyanne Conway claiming that she's feminist. It's kind of like Phyllis Schlafly back in the 1980s when she helped defeat the Equal Rights Amendment by saying women should stay home, but she traveled around the country to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. We've got a conservative feminism, so-called, that is very dangerous. I believe in a feminism that respects the choices of our own bodies, that's inclusive, that recognizes interconnected oppression, and works against injustice. So when it comes to feminism, it's much more difficult. When we look at ads for meat, in 1990, I thought, gee, here comes my book. Was I observing something that's sort of going away? I mean, we were having feminist successes. We had vegetarianism, veganism on the rise. But now when I look at these ads, there's such anxiety dripping from them about meat eating and masculinity, which is sort of hopeful because it says that while they're claimed as normative, they're actually been destabilized. And let me tell you one example. There's a beer ad in England, and it says, putting together a barbecue, a grill, 387 man points. Cooking tofu sausages on it, minus 482 man points. Look at the power of that tofu, those tofu sausages. They could undo the work of a man in, you know, on the grill just like that. So I say, you know, more tofu sausage. Well, I'm just going to correct this. We're living in a patriarchal world that is using meat eating to prop it up. I don't want our analysis to only ever look at meat eating. It's incomplete. We are living in a patriarchal world that wants to keep oppression separate and divergent from each other. The richest resource we have is to recognize interconnected oppressions and how we work through solidarity. So to begin with, I don't want our analysis to stop short. But given that as vegans in a world that believes that it's okay to eat dead animals and drink the product of reproductive exploitation, I would say that we're very literal people. In a sense, we've restored the absent referent. And we don't get why somebody else can't see that. So we'll often end up at a dinner asked why we're vegans, and we answer because we've taken them literally. They want to know. Believe me, they don't want to know. And over dinner is not the time to start articulating it because you're going to be beaten down. They're eating a dead animal in front of you. How can you restore the absent referent in the presence of the dead and absent referent? So one of the things I say is, just because a question is asked of you, you don't have to answer it then. It's better to answer a question one-on-one, to say, let's talk about this later. Don't expect your family is going to immediately embrace you because you have realized that this is the ethical thing to do. And for young people especially, one thing you could say to your parents who are giving you grief is to say, you raised me to think about these things and to be an ethical person, and I hope you see that this is a compliment to you that I've become a vegan. But you don't have to defend yourself. We've figured it out. We've moved. They haven't figured it out. So I talk about meat eaters, non-vegans, as being blocked vegetarians, blocked vegans. The point of an interaction isn't to defend how we got unblocked. It's to help them see they're blocked and what is needed. Finally, I don't think it's always words that matter. We have to allow incubation. Here we are at an art exhibit. Allow just creativity to be part of how we do outreach. I say more vegan meals without ever talking about it. Then later say, how'd you like that vegan meal? I say lots of sensuous things for vegan meals, smells and sights. I use rich pottery, very colorful, for my quinoa salads or my asparagus, grilled asparagus, to help convey that this is a beautiful thing. So my advice is don't feel you have to defend yourself, but do help people be invited in. I think that at this time when there's so much going on in the world, some people will say, you know, veganism doesn't matter. Veganism matters all the more right now. It's something that can help keep us centered. It's something that can affirm our vision and our viewpoint. It's something healthy. When things are upsetting, go cook a nice soup. Do a lot of chopping. Do something rhythmic. See veganism as the gift it is. And if that's all you can do that day, enjoy that. But the next time there's an immigration ban, be there or send vegan food. And when there's a Black Lives Matter protest, be there. March for reproductive freedom. Protest this new bathroom rescission by the Trump administration for trans students. Become a part of the fabric of your society as a vegan.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Great. So I thought we could just quickly share a few thoughts on that. She so beautifully articulates, you know, some of these connections between veganism and feminism and between, you know, a culture of subjugation of animals and patriarchy, subjugation of women. I loved at the end, too, how she kind of ties in how important it is for vegans to be involved in our community. Yeah. You know, it's really in keeping with the theme of the show today.
Yeah, for sure.
How it's important for us to be aware of human rights issues in our community and globally and to be active, you know, as vegans for all of that, and how even, you know, being vegan can just can help us do that.
Yeah, exactly. She'd be so great to have in the show to talk to. Like, she's
I think we have Allison actually had her on the show back in March. You can go look on the show. On our website, animalvoices.org, and find her interview from a while back. But yeah, in the future, I would love to interview her myself too.
Yeah.
Have you folks read her book?
Yeah, I've read both of them.
I've read a bunch of it. I didn't read the whole thing. Everything that I did read on it was so poignant.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. This, the full title for our listeners is The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory, and it's an absolutely fantastic read.
And this was written ages ago, wasn't it?
The original one was, I think she said it was originally published in 1990.
And it's still so completely relevant today.
Absolutely. Yeah, she touches a lot on, obviously it's centered on, kind of what she was talking about, the way that we associate meat eating with masculinity and how we sort of objectify animals and objectify women and how those are related. And there's also a lot about, tying in with racism and that kind of thing too, and the way people of color have been subjugated. Any other thoughts?
Well, if you get to watch the YouTube video, I don't know if we're going to post it. I just think it's so cool how she invited those artists to create something based on what they read.
Yes.
So it's really cool to look at that.
Yeah, I was sorry I missed that, actually. That it was in L.A., right? The Sexual Politics of Meat exhibition?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was all women artists who were creating pieces based on that. Yeah, so super cool.
Yeah, even like all the time still I get comments about the fact that I'm vegan and, you know, people associating with that with weakness or something.
Right, exactly.
My dad still all the time makes comments about I should be eating meat kind of stuff.
Right.
Associating it again with weakness, which is so silly.
But. Yeah. And it's so ingrained, that belief system that meat is manly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the ads still show that, making it like a pornography basically and making it sexy to be meat basically.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's kind of, we could devote an entire show to that, and
definitely.
Hopefully we will sometime.
Yeah.
You're listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories.
Now for the events. December 9th and 10th, that's tomorrow, Vancouver Chicken Save and Liberation BC welcome Chris Van Breen, one of the founders of DXE Berkeley, and he's going to present 2 days of Intro to Kingian Nonviolence and Reconciliation training. This two-day workshop is free, and if you're an organizer working for social change, an activist working to reduce violence in your community, a youth worker, organizer, or just someone who wants to learn how to resolve their personal conflicts, this workshop is for you. Also on Saturday, December 9th, is Vancouver Chicken Save's weekly chicken vigil at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse. That starts at 7 a.m. and goes to 11 a.m.
The Chicken Slaughterhouse is the one at Hastings and Commercial, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of activity there on a Saturday.
Yeah, morning. Yeah. Bright and early before work, right?
Yeah. So boycott the Vancouver Aquarium. Saturday, December 9th, come down with other activists as we spread the message of what's really happening at the Vancouver Aquarium. And that's from 11:30 to 2:30. Saturday night from 6 to 9 is the Animal Protection Party of Canada Vancouver Holiday Party. Are you going?
You know what? I don't think I can. I'm going to be out of town.
Okay.
Do you have any more details on that?
It's a party. You know Jordan Reichardt from Victoria? He's the West Coast Campaign Officer for Animal Protection Party of Canada.
Cool.
And he is putting that on to say thank you for all the support that people do in the community.
That's fantastic. Yeah, the Animal Protection Party of Canada is a relatively new political party, mm-hmm. right? Kind of a smaller party. But yeah, it's pretty amazing that we have something like that here.
And yeah, it's cool. And I want to do a shout out to Nanaimo. They are having Anonymous for the Voiceless Cube of Truth on Sunday outside Sirius Coffee on Commercial Street. Their cool. community is growing. So impressed.
Yeah. Commercial Street in Nanaimo.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah, not here.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And Jen Dobell, registered massage therapist, having a massage-a-thon this weekend to raise money for Liz Jones, who rescues strays from the USA. And you can request bookings through the Animal Voices Facebook page.
Massage-a-thon.
Excellent. Yeah, that's great.
Heard that before.
Very cool.
She's just going to have like people laying on massage tables all over the room, like going back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like great.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's a good way to use one's skills for a charitable cause. That's great.
Yeah. Have you guys heard of Peace People Apparel? Yeah. It's a conscious clothing line.
Yeah. They're based in Vancouver.
Yeah,
right?
They use recycled clothing, and they put like cool vegan messages on it. And they're going to do a pop-up shop with Willow's Wax Bar on Monday, December 11th from 5 to 8. I think cool. I'm going to go check that out.
And the pop-up shop is at Willow's Wax Bar?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Yeah, Willow's Wax Bar is a it's an all-vegan aesthetics place, right? It's salon and spa. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
So there might be some good holiday gift ideas there.
Exactly.
Saturday, December 16th from 4:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. is the Holiday Meatless Meetup Potluck. And it will be a fundraiser for the Greater Vancouver Food Bank. Entrance is by donation and cash or a non-perishable food item. Volunteers get to eat first, so if you want to volunteer, you can contact them.
Excellent.
Please bring a vegan dish to share. That means no dairy, eggs, honey, gelatin, whey, casein, or other animal products, and at least 8 servings per dish.
Mm-hmm. Cool, that sounds like fun.
So there's also going to be some raffle prizes from Sunbo Kong and Field Roast. The end of the year is going to go out with a bang. We are going to have 3 days of animal rights outreach at Cambie SkyTrain.
Right. Yeah, Cambie and Broadway.
Are you guys going to attend any of that?
I hope so.
Yeah, if I have the time, I would love to.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. A massive screen. So there's going to be Vancouver Chicken Save, Direct Action Everywhere, Anonymous for the Voices, Liberation BC, and TV Outreach for Animals are all joining forces to create this event. And that'll all be on the Facebook page.
Excellent.
So if you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Excellent. Thank you, Jillian. So our featured guest today is writer and activist Christopher Sebastian McJetters, a longtime vegan and social justice activist. advocate, sorry, Sebastian is a staff writer at Vegan Publishers, a part-time lecturer on speciesism at Columbia University, and a board member of Peace Advocacy Network. He focuses on examining the complex relationships between violence against animals, environmental racism, classism, and capitalism. Hello, Sebastian, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
Cool. So first of all, I'd love to hear about your personal journey to veganism and to social justice activism and kind of when and how you realized that all of these issues were connected.
Oh, wow. This is actually a really fun story that I just got through telling a few hours ago. So yeah, I get to tell it all over again for my friends on the radio now. Thank you for that opportunity. But yeah, like someone had just asked me about my personal journey into veganism, and my journey is kind of old, it's old for me. Like, there are definitely some older vegans out there, but I've been vegan for like 14 years now. I think that it was around 2004, early in the year, I was returning from a work trip in Las Vegas, and I had a layover on my way back to Philadelphia in Phoenix. And in the airport, I saw what I thought was a diet book, and I picked up Skinny Bitch. And I read it on the plane, and I was absolutely shook. Like, by the time I landed in Philadelphia, I was definitely vegan, or I was on my way to vegan, because I absolutely had, like, some slip-ups in the first couple of months. But in 2004, like, there just wasn't an online community for people to, like, you know, for people to connect, or at least I wasn't aware of the online community. I was just vegan in Philadelphia all by myself.
Wow.
And, so I didn't have videos. I didn't, like, you know, I didn't have a lot of online support, but I had, like, 1,000 copies of that book that I bought, and I passed out to everybody because, as we all do, you know, in my early days, I just assumed that as soon as everybody finds out, like, you know, what I just found out, then everybody's going to be vegan along with me. And, of course, that wasn't the case at all.
No.
Like, 3 months into veganism, I was like, oh, my God, the entire world sucks. Everybody is terrible. And I'm just going to burn it all down. So yeah. But, you know, and it's, like, the part of the reason why this story is, for me, really, you know, like, it's really personal and speaks a lot to my journey into social justice and social activism for all marginalized communities is because, like, you know, since that time, like, with the benefit of hindsight, as with so many things, like, you know, I realized a lot of the things that were like that were troubling, or that I should have found troubling, or should have found to be alarm bells about that book and the style that it was written in, because, you know, like, it doesn't necessarily connect with a lot of people. And, like, you know, and the type of feminism that, you know, that book encouraged isn't, like, you know, in retrospect, the most profound type of inclusive feminism that I think of now. And so, like, you know, over time, you know, I kind of started to be a little, like, you know, embarrassed about the fact that that was my entry point into veganism. But I learned to not be ashamed of that, because I actually met Carol Adams, who, of course, wrote The Sexual Politics of Meat, when I had helped to organize a conference in the Seattle area in 2015. And so I was telling Carol Adams the story kind of sheepishly, because, of course, Carol Adams, you know, she knows a thing or two about that there feminism, as they say. And, you know, I remember that she put her hand on my arm, and she said in that wise voice that we all hope to acquire someday, she's like, you know, look at where you are now. And that gave me so much hope and so much courage. And, like, you know, and it touched me so deeply, because there wasn't any judgment in that. Everybody starts somewhere. And regardless of, like, you know, what your entry point into veganism is, we all have so much more to learn and so many more ways that we can grow. And yeah, like, I had learned so much about like, not just veganism, but about feminism. And, like, and I had gotten in touch with my Blackness over so many years of being vegan, and how important and how connected veganism is to Black liberation, how important animal liberation is to Black liberation, because I didn't just read Carol Adams, but I read the work of Breeze Harper, I read the work of Lauren Ornelas, and, like, and all of this, this incredible literature that was being put together by Food Empowerment Project, by the Sista Vegan Project, by all of these incredible organizations and individual activists who are out there that made all of these connections. You know, I read, like Patrice Jones has published endlessly, and I'm a huge, huge fan of hers, and I'm fortunate enough that I get to work with Patrice at Vine Sanctuary now remotely. And, you know, and I've kind of built up this little community of people that have taught me so much and enabled me to take my activism to more radical and more daring places, because now I see, like, this isn't just about one individual thing. Like, you know, like, the veganism alone, being that animals are so closely tied up in our food system, and their exploitation and the violence that we do against them, you know, that woke me up to the fact that, like, our food system is inherently unjust, that the people who control our food system don't necessarily have our best interests at heart. And, you know, and the way that our food is distributed is incredibly unfair. And I think that the way that we approach veganism, the way that we talk about veganism, needs to change, needs to be updated for the way that we understand how the world works in the 21st century. We can't ask the same questions that we have been asking about animal exploitation. We have to look at the fact that, you know, that even if, as we're so fond of saying, even if, like, you know, corporations actually don't feed, like, grain and use our water resources to feed and provide water for animals on factory farms and in slaughterhouses, even if corporations don't do that, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to redirect those resources to poor and underprivileged communities in North America or globally, mm-hmm. Because that's just not the way that corporations work. It's just not the way that capitalism works. Mm-hmm. We still have to make sure that we're continuing that fight to free animals from exploitation, but also be really honest and, you know, and really, really transparent about what that really means. Because, yeah, like, that's something that we often say, like, you know, well, these resources are devoted to, like, factory farms, and we need to free up that food in our food system for other humans and for other animals to eat. Well, that's just not going to automatically happen. There are several steps in between that we need to undertake in order to ensure that. We also need to learn how to not use animals as our foil when insulting other humans. Mm-hmm. And we see how Black people have been animalized and are currently animalized in our societies that are dominated by images of whiteness and of white people. We need to understand, like, you know, that the animal exploitation is gendered violence, is a theft of reproductive autonomy. That animal exploitation is about queer liberation as well. We need to, like, you know, we need to broaden our understanding about how these issues are connected and why they're connected and how, like, oppression is just this hugely entangled thing with multiple threads, and you can't just undo one. You have to look at how these impact other communities as well.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more, actually, about the connections between Black liberation and animal liberation, because you've spoken about this quite a bit, and about human as a political identity that has historically been exclusively reserved for white people, specifically heterosexual white males. Can you elaborate a little more on this?
Yeah, you know, one of there was a speech that I had done, and I'm very, like, grateful and very pleased that I was asked to do this, and this was, like, 4 years ago at the National Animal Rights Day in New York when everyone had gotten together for that, where I was, like, you know, I was doing some research for this speech, and one of the things that really stuck out to me is that, like, you know, there's this exclusion that is written into, like, the U.S. Constitution of other marginalized groups, and, you know, and it really struck me that, like, when we talk about, you know, the rights that are inherent to human lives in the U.S. Constitution, like, you know, we're talking about, like, all men are created equal, as they say, the very famous quote. But that's not true, and it's never been true. Like, you know, when we say that all men are created equal, women were not included in that. Mm-hmm. queer people were not included in that, like whether they were male, female, or whatever gender you identify as, like, you know, people with, like, who are disabled, physically disabled, like who suffer from emotional trauma, and like all of these other groups were not included in that. Poor people were not included in that, and especially Black people were not included in that. Like, you know, during the time that the Constitution was written, you know, and during, like, the early days of the United States history, we were considered three-fifths of a person. We were not even considered an actual fully human person. So when we talk about all men were created equal, we were talking specifically about white, property-owning, wealthy, heterosexual, cisgender men and nobody else. Mm-hmm. So when I say human as a political identity, like, you know, this was an identity that was reserved for a very specific set of humans. And if you didn't meet these very arbitrary criteria, you were someone or something else that was not human and considered less than and inferior to. And I noticed that, like, you know, when the when this interview was being linked, you know, there was the link was to one of my talks that I had given in London at the Vevolution Festival last year. Like, one of the ways that, like, that this has been demonstrated throughout history is through medical experimentation. Black bodies and animal bodies were used in medical experimentation, and that's researched very thoroughly in the book Medical Apartheid from 2007, which I referenced in the classroom and oftentimes in my lectures, talking about the history of medical experimentation on, like, you know, on bodies that were not those of white men with money. And, like, you know, and it's really scary. You've got, like, the Tuskegee experiments that were done in the 1920s in the United States. You've got the history of Henrietta Lacks, which is the history of cancer research in the 1960s, a Black woman who died of cancer and whose, like, you know, whose cells were used for cancer research. And, like, you know, like, she died in poverty. Her family had not until, I think, 2013 even seen a dime of that money, and had received very little recognition in the decades that had passed since her life had ended. Mm. And this extends all the way through, like, you know, the 1960s and up to the 1990s, which is the most recent quote that I, like, you know, had used in one of my talks. This goes on even to this day, where doctors and people in the medical establishment are on record as saying very recently that they had no problems using specifically Black patients because we were plentiful, we were dirty, and we were greater in population than even cats. Mm-hmm. So, like, the idea of Black human persons as experimental animals is, like, you know, that's not something, that's not a comparison that I make up. That's not a comparison that I'm making. That is, like, just, you know, an acknowledgement of what living in a white supremacist society has done. That's, you know, this is something that has long been established by white people. And it creates this binary whereby Black people, particularly Black people in Western society, kind of see ourselves as in competition for liberation against other animals. And so you hear oftentimes Black people saying, like, you know, like, why should we give a fuck about animals, or white people care more about animals than they do about us? And that's where, like, you know, that's where we kind of get messed up, because, like, this isn't a competition. Oppression thrives in isolation. And this isn't, like, you know, we can seek solidarity rather than, like, you know, seeking to get a higher rung on the ladder in the oppression Olympics. So yeah, that's what I mean by that, in a very lengthy and verbose way.
No, so that's great. So I want to talk to you a little bit also about slaughterhouse workers. I mean, obviously there's quite a bit of awareness of how many agricultural workers are, you know, treated terribly. They work in terrible conditions. Slaughterhouse workers specifically, I find, don't tend to get a lot of attention, but there are rampant human rights issues in the animal slaughter industry. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, like, you know, one of the things that's really really telling that I had stumbled across, and I had also used in my lectures very recently, is that, like, well, first of all, like, let's just establish that, like, slaughterhouse workers are people who suffer from immense emotional trauma. Mm-hmm. And one of the, like, most often diagnosed conditions is PITS, that's perpetrator-induced traumatic stress. And I had started conducting my research on this, and you know, and I had also learned that, like, Food Empowerment Project had already done a tremendous amount of research on this, because a lot of the people who work in slaughterhouses are themselves undocumented immigrants, which that community is very, like, you know, very, very near and dear to the people who, like, you know, who devote their time to FEP. But many of the people who work in slaughterhouses are not our enemies. Because we crave a very simple, very straightforward black and white narrative of, like, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, it's really easy to characterize the people who work in slaughterhouses as just inherently bad people who get their jollies by killing animals. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the case. Like, people are just not hardwired like that. Slaughterhouses are oftentimes set up in economically depressed parts of the country where people have to work there or literally suffer and die because there is no other work. And that's the product of the system. The people who set the system up know that. They know that, like, you know, that you can't just find another job down the road because there are no jobs available. And sometimes in these communities, there isn't even a road. So yeah, like, these people are, like, they're overworked. They're underpaid. They don't get, like, the treatment for physical injuries that they oftentimes suffer from. And this emotional trauma manifests itself in a number of ways. In Canada's OHS, and statistics that I had taken from 2012, you can see the counties that have slaughterhouses with a medium, like, number of employees of 7,500 or more have double the rates of violent crime than counties that do not have slaughterhouses. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, what I had learned in an article that was released in February of 2016 is that, like, Syrian refugees who are fleeing, literally fleeing a war zone, and who are coming to Canada for political asylum, were actually offered jobs in slaughterhouses because Canada cannot find people who are willing to do this work. Mm-hmm. And even when faced with the threat of starvation and homelessness, a lot of these people are unable to even last for more than a couple of hours on the job. So yeah, when I say that this is closely tied to race and class discrimination, that's what this is. Like, we're literally consigning people to a type of traumatic stress that exposes them to substance abuse, to alcohol abuse, to, like, domestic violence, to higher rates of violent crime, because it has to manifest itself somehow. And in really severe cases, oftentimes people commit suicide. And we don't realize, you know, that all of this is just down to the fact that, like, we really can't give up our double cheeseburgers. Mm-hmm. So we have to find a better way for ourselves and for each other, and especially for the animals who are the ultimate victims in this, like, torturous system.
Absolutely. So, I wish we had more time. We're already almost having to wrap up here. But what are some things that we as animal rights activists can do to help make the vegan movement more inclusive and to make veganism and animal rights activism more accessible to marginalized folks?
What I would love to see is, like, a centering of more marginalized voices, or more voices that are kind of, like, floating around on the edges of the animal rights movement. So often when we, like, when we talk to people, we're citing our favorite activists, the same names come up over and over again. And what you kind of notice is that those names are usually the names of, well, cisgender, like, heterosexual white men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the prominent voices that, like, you know, that are female that I think of, they don't even come up in conversations often. There was a poll recently done on social media of, like, your favorite activists. And I'm like, you know, it's shocking and really disappointing to me that Breeze Harper doesn't appear on this, mm-hmm. that, like, you know, that Dr. Melanie Joy doesn't appear on this, that, like, you know, that Carol, once again, Carol Adams doesn't appear on this list of your favorite activists.
Wow.
And it's not that, like, you know, it's not that the people that we do find to be our favorite are bad people, or that they don't deserve recognition for their work. Everybody who, like, is vegan alone, like, you know, you're engaging in an act of political resistance. And I think that that's worth noting, because that's such an important thing to just refuse to actually consume and commodify animal bodies. So it's not that they're bad, but it's just that, like, there's such a diversity of voices out there that are not saying the same, almost very basic things over and over again. And I think that in order for us to gain credibility and join other social movements for justice, we need to recognize people who are from those movements and, like, you know, and acknowledge them, especially if they're vegan, because, like, these are our allies in the fight for social justice, and we really need to help them to understand that animals are also a marginalized community, you know, in the most severe and egregious way. Like, you know, their lives are marginalized so that they're not even seen as victims. And, you know, and the best way to do that is to raise up the voices of people who are from those communities. So, like, yeah, talk about your Black vegans, talk about your women vegans, talk about your queer vegans, and especially talk about your female, queer, and Black vegans. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, like, talk about these people that are from marginalized communities. It really gives us greater credibility when we're having these conversations, and, you know, it helps people to understand that we get it. That we see that, like, that these issues are connected, and, you know, and there's strength in numbers. We're stronger together than we are trying to go about this individually and trying to attack different issues as if they exist in a bubble.
Beautiful. Yeah, again, I so wish that we had more time. Unfortunately, we're out of time already, so we may have to have you back in the future, Sebastian, to talk about more of these issues. Oh, but thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your insights and knowledge with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate that. And I'm really excited about all of the events that you were talking about at the beginning of the program. Like, it sounds like it's going to be a really great weekend.
Awesome.
With all of the things that are going on.
Thank you.
And I love
so
Jen Dobell. She's a friend of mine on Facebook.
Oh, cool.
I never get to see
Yay.
Her. So, like, just a shout out to her.
Small world. So for our listeners, you can read some of Christopher Sebastian McJetter's work on strivingwithsystems.com and veganpublishers.com. And be sure to catch videos of his talks on YouTube as well.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 100.5 Co-op Radio, broadcasting live on unceded Coast Salish territories. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio show dedicated to animal rights and compassionate living. We invite you to connect with us online. You can follow us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR, on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver, where you can get a steady stream of animal rights-themed current events, or email us directly at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Make sure you keep listening every Friday, because as we get closer to the holidays, so do the theme of our shows. Tune in next Friday right here on 100.5 FM or online at cooperator.org, where Allison Cole is going to be speaking with Ali Beck and her mom, Sue Beck. Ali Beck is a vegan cosplayer and musician, and they'll be sharing some of their vegan stories. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith coming up next, and we will be leaving you with a song by the legendary king of soul, Sam Cooke, called Change Is A-Coming. In honor of today's show, please remember to be kind to each other. Thanks again for listening, and please remember to be kind to the animals.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know it's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gon' come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please.
But he wants.